Carnet by Albert Camus. From 1935 until his sudden death in 1960, Albert Camus kept a general literary diary, which he called his carnet, his notebooks. There he jotted down themes for future works, conversations overheard in the street, and reflections on travel, love, death, loneliness, and art. We present three programs of extracts from Carnet in the translation by Philip Thodey, selected by Anthony Asprey. The reader is John Shrapnel. Program 1, Random Thoughts.
In the Balearic Isles last summer, what gives value to travel is fear. It's the fact that at a certain moment, when we're so far from our own country, a French newspaper acquires incalculable value, and those evenings when in cafes you try to get close to other men just to touch them with your elbow, we're seized by a vague fear and an instinctive desire to go back to the protection of old habits. This is the most obvious benefit of travel. At that moment, we're feverish, but also porous, so that the slightest touch makes us quiver to the depths of our being. We come across a cascade of light, and there is eternity. This is why we should not say that we travel for pleasure. There's no pleasure in traveling, and I look upon it more as an occasion for spiritual testing. If we understand by culture the exercise of our most intimate sense, that of eternity, then we travel for culture. Pleasure takes us away from ourselves in the same way as distraction, in Pascal's use of the word, takes us away from God. Travel, which is like a greater and a graver science, brings us back to ourselves. Every time I hear a political speech, or I read those of our leaders, I'm horrified at having for years heard nothing which sounded human. It's always the same words telling the same lies. And the fact that men accept this, that the people's anger has not destroyed these hollow clowns, strikes me as proof that men attribute no importance to the way that they're governed, that they gamble, yes, gamble with a whole part of their life and their so-called vital interests. Above all, in order to be, never try to seem. The innocent is the person who explains nothing. The mistake, said M, lies in thinking that you must choose, that you must do what you want, and that there are conditions for happiness. Happiness either is or it isn't. It's the will to happiness which matters, a kind of vast, ever-present awareness. Everything else, women, art, worldly triumphs, are just so many pretexts, an empty canvas for us to decorate. Character. A.M. An invalid, both legs amputated, paralyzed all down one side. They help me when I want to relieve myself, he says. They wash me. I'm practically deaf. But I would never do a thing to cut short a life in which I believe so strongly. I would accept even worse, blindness, deprivation of all my senses, loss of the power of speech, and of any contact with the external world, as long as I could feel within me this dark, burning flame which is me, and me alive. And I should still give thanks to life for having let me continue to burn with its flame. The spirit of revolution lies wholly in man's protest against the human condition. Under the different forms which it assumes, it's in this respect the only eternal theme of art and religion. A revolution is always carried out against the gods, from that of Prometheus onwards. It's a protest which man makes against his destiny, and both tyrants and bourgeois puppets are nothing but pretexts. People talk a lot nowadays about the dignity of work and about the need for it. Monsieur Gignoux, in particular, has very definite ideas on the subject. but it's a fraud. There's dignity in work only when it's work freely accepted. Only idleness has a moral value because it can serve as a criterion by which to judge men. It's fatal only to the second rate. That is its lesson and its greatness. Work, on the other hand, crushes everyone down to the same level. It provides no basis for judging men. It brings into action a metaphysic of humiliation. Under the form of slavery which the society of right-thinking people now give it, the best men cannot survive its effects. I suggest that we stand the usual expression on its head and make work a fruit of laziness. There is a dignity of labor in the little barrels which men make for themselves on Sundays. Here, work and play come together again, and play, linked with technique, attains the dignity of a work of art and of creation itself. Artist and work of art. The true work of art is the one which says least. There is a certain relationship between the global experience of an artist, his thought plus his life, his system in one sense, leaving out anything systematic which this word implies, and the work reflecting this experience. This relationship is wrong when the work gives the whole of the experience surrounded by a fringe of literature, and it's right when the work of art is a section cut out of his experience, the facet of a diamond in which the gem's inner luster is reflected but not exhausted. Now, in the first case, there's exaggeration and literature. And in the second, a work which is fruitful because of a whole implied content of experience whose wealth is not directly expressed. The problem is to acquire that knowledge of life, or rather to have lived, which goes beyond the mere ability to write. So that in the last analysis, the great artist is first and foremost a man who's had a great experience of life, it being understood that in this case, living also implies thinking about life, that living is, in fact, precisely this subtle relationship between a man's experience and his awareness of it. To live alone in one room in Paris for a year teaches a man more than 100 literary salons and 40 years' experience of Parisian life. It's a hard, terrible, and sometimes agonizing experience, and always on the verge of madness. But by being close to such a fate, a man's quality must either become hardened and tempered, or perish. And if it perishes, then it's because it was not strong enough to live. The wind, one of the few clean things in the world. They've all betrayed us. Those who preached resistance and those who talked of peace. There they are, all as docile and guilty as one another. And never before has the individual stood so alone before the lie-making machine. He can still feel contempt and use it as a weapon. And if he has no right to stand on one side and feel scorn, he still has the right to judge. Humanity in general, the crowd, can offer nothing. Was treason to believe the opposite. We die alone. They are all going to die alone. Let the man who is alone at least keep his scorn and the ability to pick out from this terrible ordeal what serves his own greatness. Accept the ordeal and everything which it entails, but swear, in the least noble of tasks, to perform only the noblest of actions. And real nobility, that of the heart, is based on scorn, courage, and profound indifference. To be born to create, to love, to win at games, is to be born to live in time of peace. But war teaches us to lose everything and become what we were not. It all becomes a question of style. There are many reasons for the official hostility towards England, good or bad, political or non-political, but no one mentions one of the worst motives. Fury, and the ignoble desire to see the person who dares stand up to the strength that has overwhelmed you go down himself. Idea. Because of a deeper demand, he refuses everything offered to him and all his chances for happiness. He ruins his marriage, gets involved in unsatisfactory affairs, waits and hopes. I can't really define it, but I can feel it. And so on till he dies. No, I shall never be able to define it. For a generous psychology. We help a person more by giving him a favorable image of himself than by constantly confronting him with his faults. Everyone normally tries to be like the best image of himself. This can be extended to education, history, philosophy, and politics. We, for example, are the result of 20 centuries of Christian imagery. For 2,000 years, man has been presented with a humiliated image of himself. We can see the result. Who can say what we would have become if these 20 centuries had seen the continuation of the classical ideal with its admirable image of man? Living with one's passions also means living with one's sufferings, which form a counterweight, a corrective, a means of balancing and paying for them. When a man has learnt, and not on paper, to remain alone in the intimacy of his suffering, to overcome his desire to run away, the illusion that other people can share, then he has little left to learn. Death gives form to love as it does to life by transforming it into destiny. The woman you love died while you loved her, and here henceforth is a love fixed forever, which, without this end, would have dissolved in fragments. What would the world thus be without death, but a succession of forms fading away and being reborn, an anguished flight, an uncompletable world? But happily, death, the stable one, is here. And the lover weeping over the corpse of his beloved, René of Apolline, sheds tears of pure joy, of the all is fulfilled, of the man who recognizes that finally his destiny has taken on form. Saint-Étienne and its suburbs. A sight like this is a condemnation of the civilization which brought it to birth. A world in which there is no more room for human beings, for joy, for active leisure, is a world that should die. No people can live outside beauty. It can live on after itself for a time, and that's all. And this Europe, which here offers one of its most permanent faces, is ceaselessly moving away from beauty. And that's why it's in such convulsions, and why it will die, if peace does not mean for it a return to beauty, and the restoration of its rightful place, to love. Any life aimed at money is a death. Rebirth lies in disinterestedness. Classicism means confidence in words, but to retain this confidence, it uses them only prudently. Surrealism, which mistrusts them, abuses them. Let us go back to classicism through modesty. I don't find humanism unpleasant. I even find it quite attractive. But I find it doesn't go very far. There is a stage in every suffering, every emotion, every passion, when it belongs to the most individual and inexpressible part of man. And a stage in which it belongs to art. But in its first stage, art can never do anything with it. Art is the distance which time gives to suffering. It's man's transcendence with regard to himself. Finally, I choose liberty. For even if we do not achieve justice, liberty still keeps the power to protest against injustice and preserves communication. Liberty means being able to defend opinions I do not hold, even in a regime or a world that I approve of. It's the ability to let one's opponent be right. I have a very keen liking for freedom, and for any intellectual, freedom finally becomes inseparable from freedom of expression. But I'm perfectly well aware that for a very great number of Europeans, this concern does not come first, since only justice can give them the basic standard of living which they need, and rightly or wrongly, they'd be quite willing to sacrifice freedom to this elementary justice. I've known this for a long time. If I felt it necessary to defend the bringing together of justice and liberty, it would be because I thought this was the last hope of the West. But they can be brought together only in a certain atmosphere, which today strikes me as almost utopian. It needs tumbrils filled with blood and centuries of history to achieve an imperceptible change in the human condition. Such is the law. For years, heads fall like hail, terror reigns, men cry revolution, and what's finally achieved is the replacement of absolute by constitutional monarchy. After 2,000 years of Christianity, the revolt of the body. It's taken 2,000 years for us once again to be able to show it naked on the beaches. Hence the excess. And it's recovered its place in our customs. What we now have to do is to restore its place in philosophy and metaphysics. This is one of the meanings of the modern convulsion. Later, write an essay with no reservations and no consideration for other people on what I know is true. Doing what we don't want, wanting what we don't do. If we believe in moral values, we believe in morality right up to and including sexual morality. The reform is a total one. We must find love before finding morality, otherwise, anguish. Commitment. I have the highest and most passionate idea of art. Much too high to agree to submit it to anything. Much too passionate to wish to separate it from anything.
That was John Shrapnel reading extracts from Carnet, the notebooks of Albert Camus, translated by Philip Thody and selected by Anthony Asprey. The program was directed by John Theocharis.